thank you for this invitation to talk about BSM theory to all of you grad students here who may or may not be doing BSM as part of your project. But I kind of feel like BSM is what fundamental physics is really all about. So I may be biased in that sense, but what is the point of doing fundamental physics if it isn't to try and find what the theory beyond the standard model is? So the ultimate goal is, what is the underlying theory? And this can be answered in many different ways. We can either try and discover experimental signs of what is beyond the standard model. We could find cosmological or astrophysical signs. Or we could find signs in collider experiments and particle experiments and so on. Or we could discover a new theory that is just so compelling that we feel that this must be the underlying theory. But really, it's the interplay of all these things, which is what we mean by BSM. Okay, so I like to think of it as the overlap of the more formal side of theory, the overlap of particle physics, and the overlap of astro and cosmo. Okay, so this is something like all of these aspects where you may have a preference for one of these things, okay? But I think we should keep in mind that if there are signs of new physics, what is the consequence for the theory beyond the standard model? Now, there will be some overlap with the other lectures. For example, I think you have a dedicated lecture on axions. You've had dedicated lectures on dark matter. And even with the amplitudes lectures that you had this morning, I'll mention those briefly in respect to how this can also inform the way that we think about theories beyond the standard model. So this will necessarily be a bit more of an overview and less of actually explaining and deriving things. I'll try and give you some literature notes where you can actually find more information on these things. And you can find some of the contents of this lecture in some BSM lectures, for example, by Matthew McCullough, who gave these lectures not so long ago. This is on INSPIRE. So let me put the references here. Some lecture notes by Andrea Wolzer, for example, on composite Higgs models, for example, can be found on this archive reference. And then we have some excellent notes on supersymmetry by Hitoshi Murayama, again on the archive reference 0002232. Okay, so I'll just put these here for you to look up during this week if you'd like to know a bit more about the things that I'll touch upon.
Sorry, what's his last surname?
Oh, Murayama, sorry. That's Hitoshi Murayama. Yeah, sorry for my terrible handwriting. Just stop me and ask me if I don't write something very clearly. You can also email me, okay, at this email address if you have any questions, and I'll try and either answer you in person or by email or point you to some more references. I'll also maybe put up some more literature on things which are good reads for example, for naturalness. There's a few very good references that I recommend everyone to read. Okay, so given the vast array of topics that usually constitutes BSM, yep?
Yeah, sorry, just a quick question. So does the theory here, does it, like, is it something specific here, or is it just like, you know, every like aspect of theoretical physics that you could have? I'm just a bit.
It's everything. I mean, it's basically, it's everything from the more formal aspects of theory, like the kind of positivity and amplitudes methods and so on, which relate to BSM in many different ways. They can be used as a probe of BSM, they can be used as a way of calculating standard model amplitudes that allows you to compare the results of LHC experiments with predictions from BSM to, you know, entirely different new types of symmetries, for example, like generalized symmetries that people are now interested in, which may have consequences phenomenologically, to string theory, which, you know, connects with string phenomenology and different expectations for experiments from there. So it's everything, basically. It's very broad, right? But, you know, while some people are interested in these things in themselves, some people are just interested in the mathematical apparatus of formal theory, some people are interested in mathematical games, and some people are interested in particle physics for its own sake, just understanding, you know, QCD better and so on. My point is that if you're doing DSM, you're a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none. Okay, that's the way I think of myself, essentially. So I'm not going to have time to really go into detail on any topic, which is another way of saying I don't know much about any topic, okay? But I sort of put them all together in ways that I think is compelling in terms of trying to find what is the core of what is interesting about all these different developments and how do we actually make progress on what I consider the central question of why I'm doing physics, okay? I think there's many motivations for doing physics. So the outline of the different topics, which I'll try and glance upon, will first start with the standard model, okay, is an effective field theory. And this is the topic of today's lecture. I want to really emphasize the entryway into BSM in some ways is to first appreciate that the standard model is an effective field theory of some underlying deeper UV theory. And this is a framework within which we understand the results of experiments, within which we understand the theoretical structure of the standard model, its success and also its failures, and the context in which we'll discuss some issues like naturalness and how to interpret data. The other topics that this will lead on to, as I mentioned, is what is one of the central problems of fundamental physics at the moment is naturalness. And this can raise a lot of skepticism, and at the same time, it can also raise a lot of strong feelings on both sides of, is this a real problem? Is it not? Is it something we should pay attention to? The problem is also that it can mean lots of different things. Okay, so I want to emphasize some of the more, some of the less debatable aspects of why this is technically a real problem and some of the more aesthetic aspects of what this problem is about. The third topic that this will then lead on to is the conventional solutions to some of these problems. The main one being super symmetry. So I think to understand where BSM is today, we need to understand where it was yesterday. And where it's going, in some sense, is informed by the successes and failures of the past. But you know, you really have to appreciate why people considered it so motivating in the past. And I'll try to emphasize that there are also some reasons independent of the naturalness problem that motivates things like supersymmetry. And even if it is nothing to do with our real world, even if you don't think it's interesting as a theory, it is still something that is a good example of what a extension of the standard model should look like and one of the most successful ways of doing so. So in that sense, it's a very useful example of what a paradigmatic theory of BSM should look like. But there are alternatives. They're not mutually exclusive either, in the sense that these theories can be viable together with other theories. So it's not like it's one or the other, but people were considering before the LHC switched on that the Higgs may be accompanied by supersymmetric particles, or it may turn out to be a bit heavier and be something that we call a composite Higgs. As it turns out, the discovery of the Higgs is at a mass that is exactly at the upper end of the minimal supersymmetric expectation and exactly at the lower end of the expectation from a composite Higgs model. So we still don't know whether it could be one or the other or just an elementary Higgs with no supersymmetry or compositeness, but it's still a possibility that it could be one or the other if we probe the Higgs sector more precisely. The other reason why these theories are interesting is that composite Higgs models can also be a low energy effective theory of extra dimensional theories at higher scales. Okay, so we have the kind of idea in mind that maybe the spatial dimensions that we can access are only some of the ones that we can see. These ideas in string theory are not necessarily related, but can be related to the types of large, the warped extra dimensions that could also explain why the Higgs mass is so light. And finally, if I have time, we'll go into other types of theories that try to explain naturalness problems in not necessarily the Higgs, but something called the strong CP problem. I think you'll have a dedicated lecture on this, so I don't know how much overlap there'll be, but these ideas have also motivated applying the same types of cosmological dynamics to understand the Higgs. And these are so-called relaxon models, which, while not especially compelling at this point, are extremely interesting just as a proof of principle that maybe there's some alternative ways of going beyond the standard model and explaining features of the standard model structure that don't use the conventional type of approaches we had before. Okay, that's a very general introduction. I think the variety of topics covered here is really related to naturalness as a central issue. And talking about the standard model as an EFT is the way in which I will try and introduce these topics. I won't go into things like flavor model building, neutrino model building, all kinds of other model building that aims to also solve other problems with the standard model. Okay, but these are also things that that have very interesting experimental signatures and observational consequences. Okay, so it's a bit strange to do the standard model as an effective field theory when you've already done first gravity as an effective field theory. So the standard model is usually meant to be just the quantum field theory without gravity of the fermions and forces that don't include gravity, but really it's all part of the same framework. Okay, if you add a spin 2 to the standard model, then this is the effective field theory at low energies, which includes gravity as well. Now, the old understanding of QFT is something that was the way people thought of quantum field theory until about the 1970s. Okay. And this is still, in some sense, the way in which we teach QFT at an undergrad level. Okay, we still learn, in a sense, the historical way in which quantum field theory was arrived upon. And in some ways, it's based on a misconception that renormalizability is the key criteria for picking out theories. This is why, in a sense, QED was considered to be the most successful quantum field theory of that time, and the reason why the quantum electrodynamics Lagrangian was truncated up to dimension 4 was because it was the only way in which you could renormalize a finite number of parameters to make predictions that got rid of the infinities. And this is why, in a sense, it's Hooft's proof of the renormalizability of Weinberg's model of leptons was the key to the start of the acceptance of what we call the standard model. So I'll write standard model, but this was really Weinberg's 1967 or so paper that put together the Higgs mechanism and the non-abelian gauge mechanism together with the Yukawa couplings, and this is what he called his model of leptons. But it had no citations until the early 1970s. Okay. Even Weinberg sort of put it aside. And the reason that no one really took it seriously at the time was because it was not considered a renormalizable theory. Now, people paid attention after this proof, even before the 1974 discovery of neutral currents, and after that discovery, that really started the acceptance of the standard model, which, after the discovery of the W and Z boson in the 1980s, you know, solidified this. But really, the acceptance began with a theoretical acceptance of the theory based on renormalizability being the key criteria. Now, this turns out to have been a necessary restriction in the sense that we now understand, thanks to Wilson and Weinberg and others like Polshinsky in the 70s, that these QFDs are really effective field theories. The rules of the game there are very different to the way people wrote down Lagrangians ad hoc in the previous times. And the rule is that once the particles are fixed and their quantum numbers are fixed, then you have to write down all the possible terms that are allowed by the symmetries. Where the symmetries are the gauge invariants and Lorentz invariants that you impose. And this includes not only all the terms up to dimension 4, which is what we usually call the standard model, but also the higher dimensional terms. And by higher dimension, what I mean here is the operator mass dimension. Okay, let me explain by operator mass dimension, I mean in natural units, h bar equals c equals 1. Okay, you can count the mass dimension of the field. Scalar fields have mass dimension 1, fermions mass dimension 3/2, and so on. Okay, so this means, yep.
Yeah, so just a question. So when you say that the standard model and the FD, so would you mean that it's like the standard model as we understand it now would be the leading of order of that EFT?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah. And what we usually, when we say the standard model, we usually mean the dimension 4 Lagrangian.
Yeah.
Okay, when I say standard model effective field theory, I mean plus all the higher dimensional operators.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Now, just as a as an aside for this sort of point of view, it's very much in line with the kind of philosophy that Gell-Mann coined as the totalitarian principle. Okay. Has anyone heard this principle before? Nope. Yes? Do you remember how it goes exactly? No. Okay, I'm sort of paraphrasing here. I don't know what he wrote exactly, but it's something like anything that isn't forbidden is compulsory.
I think that's a general principle in physics, not only in that specifically.
Yeah, this was originally referred to, I mean, it wasn't Gell-Mann who came up with this. I think this was something that in the time was a general saying,
yeah.
But I think it was Gell-Mann who first wrote this in a paper to describe quantum mechanics. Okay. In the sense that you're summing over all the possibilities and anything that's not forbidden is compulsory. You have to sum over all these possibilities. Now, where this is not an empty statement is in the sense that, for example, in a classical theory, lots of things aren't forbidden. You can write down all kinds of crazy forces and potentials and so on, okay? But one of the remarkable things of the last century of fundamental physics is that all of these things have gotten tighter and tighter and conceptually less arbitrary. We now understand why certain things in classical mechanics are not possible from the point of view of quantum mechanics, and in particular from relativity, putting together with quantum mechanics restricts a lot the possibilities that we can write down. And what this means in the context of the standard model effective field theory or effective field theories in general is that we now understand that these capture all the possible things that can happen that are allowed by the symmetries of your theory. And in some sense, they're just a convenient way of writing down the restrictions from the symmetries of your theory. When we write down a Lagrangian with all the possible terms, we're saying we don't know what the UV theory is, but it has to obey certain symmetries, and all the operators that we write down are the restrictions that are allowed by these symmetries. So another way in which one can think of this saying is that if you have a finite set of possibilities and you've seen all of them except one, then it would be very strange for that one thing not to be there. There's also something else that Gell-Mann was doing around that time in the 60s, which he termed the eightfold way. How many of you have heard of the eightfold way? Yes? Okay, I think that's part of a standard particle physics class where at the time, the puzzle was all the different types of particles that were appearing. They call kaons in addition to the pions, and all the different mesons were appearing. And Gell-Mann found they could all fit in this type of octet. You also had the decouplet, where you had all these other particles. Okay, but there was one missing. So in this pattern, you find all the masses and charges of particles as you expect, but there was one missing, and he predicted this as the omega baryon. And again, I would say that this is sort of a very compelling way to argue that it has to be there. And even if experimentally you don't find it, then your likelihood is that it's not there's something wrong with this argument, it's that there must be something going on, something funny as to why that is not there. But as it turns out, they discovered it just a couple of years later, and the discovery of the omega baryon in 1964 was one of the big start of the picture that led to QCD. Okay. I think these examples from the way the standard model was developed is very useful to think about when we go forwards, because many of these things are not so different to situations we find ourselves in now. At the time as well, QCD was not known in 1964. There's a BBC documentary called Strangers Minus Three, which you can find on YouTube, I think, which you have to watch because it's just great. You have people like, you know, Feynman explaining this picture. You have the experimentalist that shows how they were looking for this in photographs, and then they pull out the event with the Omega baryon, you know, decaying and so on. And then Feynman is saying, you know, this is like a great step, but we don't know what the underlying theory is. And at the time, they thought QFT was a dead end. They thought QFT was very successful for QED, but by the late 1960s, it was considered a backwater of physics. No one was doing QFT seriously, apart from people like Peter Higgs and so on, trying to come up with a mechanism. Because they really thought that that strong dynamics would require a whole new different type of theory. You know, Feynman in that documentary is saying, we need a whole different way of writing down theories. We need something radically new, something, you know. And what did it turn out to be? Just another regime of non-abelian gauge theories, okay? So that in itself, I think, is quite remarkable that it didn't have to be that way, but we use the same structure, the same abelian generalization to non-abelian to describe not only the electroweak force, but also the strong force. And it turns out there's very good arguments for why it had to be that way. There's not so many different possibilities when you put together relativity and quantum mechanics, as I'll maybe touch upon later. Okay, so this modern understanding is really based on the fact that QFTs, as we write them for the standard model, are not fundamental, but low energy. Low energy approximations to some underlying theory. There is a sense in which also the totalitarian principle of EFTs is related to the one of quantum mechanics, in the sense that when you go from the UV theory down to IR theories, the renormalization group evolution will generate all the different possibilities that are allowed by the symmetries, even if in your UV theory you switch off certain things. Now, the prototypical EFT that we are more familiar with is known as Fermi theory. Back in the 1940s, you could really think of it as the EFT of QED. The rule is that you write down all the possible operators that are allowed by the symmetries of your theory, and you include all the experimentally discovered degrees of freedom at that energy scale. So at the time, you not only had the Lagrangian of QED. Okay, let me write it here. Which would be your kinetic term for the fermions. And the gauge bosons. But you also write down the higher dimensional terms, which includes then a dimension six operator with some coefficient, C, and this gamma is some general matrix structure that could be one of the, either the identity, it could be a gamma matrix, it could be a gamma five, okay, and so on. And you can also write down a dimension eight operator, which involves the gauge bosons. Okay, and since this is dimension eight, this would come with some 1 over lambda to the 4. Okay, and you can write down lots of other variations on this. But the point is that this lambda is the cutoff of your effective field theory. So you think of some high energy scale above the scale of your EFT. So let's say back in Fermi's days, this was the GeV scale. And you think of lambda as being some cutoff at some scale higher than that, which at the time was unknown. Yep?
It is supposed we have started with ordinary Lagrangian at QED, under which Feynman diagram C6 and C8 are generated.
Yep, good. So the kind of diagram which we have for this dimension 6 operator is a contact interaction, which you saw in the last lecture. Okay, which looks like this. Okay, so you have four fermions interacting through this contact interaction that is proportional to this coefficient, where C6 is some dimensionless, what we call a Wilson coefficient, and lambda is the dimensionful scale. Okay.
Because you said that even if we set C6 and C8 to be zero, they will be generated.
Yep.
Right?
Good.
Right now you have generated.
Yes, yes.
Already. Yep. But before this generation, what kind of diagram generates this vertex?
Good. So you're anticipating where I'm going to get to, which is that at higher energies, the standard model Lagrangian includes extra degrees of freedom, the W and the Z and the Higgs and so on. And when you go down to lower energies, those remain heavy and you're left with your low energy degrees of freedom. And those extra degrees of freedom generate these, okay? So that's the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian, okay, that you also heard about this morning. This was actually written down in 1933, I think. Okay, their motivation was a classical theory of electrodynamics that had a cut off to the energy density of the electromagnetic field, but that's a historical motivation. From the modern point of view, this is there as a diagram that looks like this. Okay, if you have, say, scattering of light by light, it would look like this kind of diagram. And the Fermi theory, as you know, is written down in the 1930s to describe things like radioactive decay or other kinds of processes that couldn't be described by QED at the time. So in a way, we'd be doing EFTs even before we knew what an EFT was. Okay, these theories were all written down in different ways. But now we know that all these terms have to be there based on the fact that QED is just an effective field theory. So let's do the same with the standard model. Okay. And write down all the possible terms for this theory. Again, once we fix the quark content, okay, we have there are quantum numbers under SU3C, SU2L, and U1Y. Then this is all that we need to know how they transform under the gauge symmetries. And this then fixes all the allowed terms that we can write down. Let me just write the leptons and the Higgs for completeness, where we have 1, 2, minus 1 half, the singlets, and the Higgs. Hey, wait, you may have different conventions for the hypercharges, but yep.
I don't want to go back, but in general, with these extra terms we're considering,
yep.
How do you handle that we can also build those terms from loop diagrams?
Yep.
are we considering them or just?
Do you mean generate them?
Yeah, for example, then you
yes.
have a loop of Fermi's.
So this in the standard model, for example, could be generated at higher energies by this kind of box diagram.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So in the standard model, at energies larger than, say, the masses of the particles that go in this loop, so let's say above the muon mass, for example, if this is the muon that goes in there, okay, in QED, you already have this diagram with the electron in the loop. And then at higher energies above the mass of the muon, you'll also have this diagram. But in the EFT below the mass of the muon, you'll have this diagram, which involves the coefficient C8. Okay. And it's precisely in the procedure known as matching, when you go from the high energy theory to the low energy theory, that you match the result of this calculation to this calculation. And you find that this C8 is going to be proportional to the coupling divided by some loop factor and the masses of the muon. Okay.
So we're considering that those terms are coming from the standard model itself.
In this case, we know the UV theory. So yes, we know that the UV theory of Fermi theory and QED is the standard model. And we now know that the UV completion of, you know, for example, this four fermion diagram involves the W. And this is the prototypical EFT that we always learn about. You have the W propagator, something like 1 over p squared minus mw squared, which you can write as 1 over mw squared, 1 over p squared over mw squared minus 1. And so at energies far below mw, this is just approximately minus 1 over mw squared. And so the coefficient, well, you also have the coupling involved in this. Okay, and so when you match this diagram to this one, and you take the low energy limit of this one, you find that your C6 is the coefficient squared, and your lambda squared is the mass of the W squared. OK? Yep?
Sorry, I can't read what the symbols are in the bottom row.
In this one?
Yeah, and also
yep.
on the left.
Oh, OK, sorry. So this is the down right. And it's a triplet under SU3, so that's a 3. It's a singlet under SU2L, so that's a 1, and it's minus 1/3 for the hypercharge. And the Higgs is a singlet under SU3, so that's a 1, doublet under SU2L, so that's a 2, and a half for the hypercharge. Okay. So yeah, this is a good example to keep in mind because we know already that the standard model itself, when you go down to low energies, gives you an effective field theory with higher dimensional operators. And all the possible terms where we have all these different Wilson coefficients, okay, we call them Wilson coefficients, can be constrained experimentally. And they can be matched theoretically to the UV theory that gives you what you expect in different theories for these different coefficients. For example, had this operator not been generated by what we call a tree-level diagram, but instead is a loop-level diagram, then you'd expect an additional loop factor of suppression, for example.
May I ask another question?
Yep.
Under RG flow, C6 and C8 will flow to 0, right? So the run of C6 and C8.
Why would they flow to 0?
Don't know irrelevant, no?
Yes, so the technical terms for dimension, so for D less than 4, we call them relevant. Okay, D equals 4 is sometimes called marginal, and D greater than 4 is sometimes called irrelevant. Okay. I mean, those are just terms that are related to the fact that you have a suppression of the higher dimensional operator terms by 1 over some heavy scale, which is part of the reason why we understand the successes of the standard model structure. Okay, the reason why, it's great, all your questions are anticipating exactly what I'm going to talk about. So what I was going to get upon later was the fact that the reason why the dimension 4 Lagrangian was so successful at describing physics, and we could neglect all these higher dimensional operator terms, is that they are suppressed by some heavy scale, so their effects are expected to be smaller. And indeed, if we write down, okay, I was starting to write down the quantum numbers, which then fixes the standard model Lagrangian, then all these allowed terms are indeed there in what we call the standard model Lagrangian. But they're there just by enumerating all the possibilities, and it just happens that this is all the ones we've observed. Okay, so we have the usual kinetic terms for the matter fields. We have the usual, again, you know, we just write down these field strengths, but really if you just write down all the vector and derivative terms that you can contract in the Lorentz invariant ways and get rid of redundancies and so on, then it collapses into precisely this, okay? This should really be the hypercharge field strengths. And then we have the SU2 field strengths and the color field strengths. Okay. And then the Higgs terms are also all the possible terms, where I'll just write VH for the Higgs potential.
Why is there no color indices on the gluons?
Because I'm lazy. I mean,
Oh. <laughs> Yeah.
There should be one here. I used A for that. Let me use I. OK. The Yukawa terms, OK, YD. Okay, and the lepton equivalents. Okay, now when I emphasize that all these terms are there because I'm writing down all the possible combinations that are allowed by the symmetries, it's to emphasize that there is one more term I could have written down, okay, which involves the CP odd field strength for the gluon. Okay, and the coefficient that we usually call theta, okay, and well, some factors which aren't important, but this term is something that we could have written down, and I'll come back to this term when we talk about the strong CP problem, or it's sometimes called the theta problem, the theta strong CP problem. Okay, for those of you who are familiar with the story, it's the one of this term violating CP in the strong sector, which could give a contribution to the neutron electric dipole moment. But the fact that we haven't seen this effect places a limit on theta being a parameter that is extremely tiny. Now, this is a puzzle for many reasons. Okay, this is something which I'll hopefully have time to talk about later. It's puzzling because this gets several contributions which have nothing to do with each other, and yet they have to cancel to give you this very tiny number. But again, even without even knowing where this comes from, it's puzzling from the point of view of this totalitarian principle and this effective field theory structure, where given that everything that is allowed is possible, we've now detected these terms as well. Not all of them. We still haven't established the first generation and all the second generation Yukawa couplings. And we still haven't measured the Higgs trilinear, but I think you'll all agree that these terms are there in the Lagrangian. And yet this term, it'd be very strange for it to just not be there. Okay. This can be written as a total derivative, but even as a total derivative, it doesn't vanish due to very interesting topological structure of QCD. But that's something which we might not have time to go into. Okay, so we've written down all these terms. Now we again want to say this is an effective field theory, and we have to write down the dimension 5, the dimension 6, the dimension 8, 7, and 8, and so on, okay? So let me rub out this board. Okay, I'm not rubbing this out to make space to write down all these terms because we'd be here for quite a while, given that there's about 2,499 dimension 6 operators if we write down all the possible combinations. Now, let me start with dimension 5, where there's only one.
Yeah.
So that's a bit more easy to write down. This is known as the Weinberg operator. Again, he was one of the first to really understand this EFT structure and the fact that the Weinberg operator, or the dimension 5 one, is the first one that you can write at the next order. And this involves a lepton number violating operator that when the Higgs gets a VEV, okay, contributes to the mass of the neutrino. Okay, so this coefficient C5 is again some Wilson coefficient that we don't know. This lambda is some heavy scale of whatever UV physics generates this operator. And there's many different ways in which the neutrino can get its mass from heavy new physics. But at low energies, this is one of the ways in which some of these models can generate a low energy operator that then generates mass for the neutrinos. When I said that this EFT structure, yep.
Isn't technically, like, you know, this is not a lepton number conserving operator, so technically that would be like two new bars, because, you know, it's like two antineutrinos, or like not.
Yeah, I'm just writing the mass term here for the neutrino field, okay, so how you write that down depends on if you're writing Weyl fermions, Dirac fermions, and so on, okay, so yeah.
Because when you break it down, you get like two, you don't get like a neutrino and an antineutrino, but you get like two antineutrinos, or two neutrinos if you look at it.
Yeah, so this is a Majorana mass term for the neutrinos, okay. Look, you could also write down a new low energy degree of freedom, okay. This is not something that isn't possible in any way. I mean, it's very easy to say that we can add a mass term for the neutrino by just adding a light new singlet fermion and give it a Yukawa coupling just like for the other particles. Okay, so that's possible. You have to put in a Yukawa value that is absolutely tiny, 10 to the minus 9 or something like that, or even smaller, 10 to the minus 12, I think. But there's no reason why not, given that, well, you know, the Yukawa for the electron is 10 to the minus 6, and the Yukawa for the top is of order 1. So you already have Yukawas that vary for no reason over 6 orders of magnitude. So who knows, maybe the electron, maybe the neutrinos are just another right-handed singlet fermion that you add with a Yukawa, and you put that Yukawa in by hand to be very small. But on the other hand, it's also very compelling that you just have this dimension 5 operator, and this dimension 5 operator does give masses to the neutrinos when the Higgs gets a VEV, and you have a natural way to understand why why this neutrino mass is so much lighter than all the other particles, because it comes with a suppression by some heavy scale. So if C5 is of order 1, then this scale is something like 10 to the 10 GeV, 10 to the 14 GeV even. And some of the models that generate this are to add a very heavy right-handed neutrino. And this very heavy right-handed neutrino induces a mass matrix, a 2x2 mass matrix, that when you diagonalize gives one very heavy, one very light degree of freedom. So this is called a seesaw mechanism. Okay. So I'll just write seesaw. But this is just one possible example. Okay, there's some models where you have a much lighter right-handed neutrino, and then you have a very suppressed C5, and these models can also generate this operator. And then you have other models where this doesn't exist, but you generate it at dimension 7, which also violates lepton number, and dimension 5 is forbidden. Okay, so as you can see, just for this one operator, there's all kinds of model building and phenomenology that one can do. And it explains the structure of global symmetries of the standard model that experimentally was just something that in the 50s and 60s confused people a bit. Why were some symmetries somewhat accidental and not exact? And why were some exact? And the reason why is that some symmetries, like the SU2 isospin that rotates a proton and neutron together, are only approximate because they're not fundamental symmetries. They are approximately respected by some terms, and they're broken by others. And if they're not broken too badly, then you can use this approximate global symmetry to understand some features in your experimental data, like the fact that they have to arrange themselves in these representations. But we now understand that global symmetries, like lepton number and baryon number, are accidental. They are accidental symmetries in the sense that they are a byproduct of imposing the more fundamental symmetries, gauge invariance and Lorentz invariance, and the fact that there's only a finite number of combinations that we can write down, and it just happened that those finite combinations don't violate a global lepton and baryon number. But as we go to higher dimensions, we can write down more combinations, and so we expect, naturally, that some of them could violate lepton and baryon number. And indeed, they do at dimension 5. And we expect B violation at dimension 6. Okay, this is, for example, a proton decay operator. Let's call this Cp over lambda squared, where you have three fermions and a lepton. Okay, I won't write down the bars or anything like that. Okay, this is just schematic. But this kind of operator that violates baryon and lepton number could lead to things like proton decay. Okay, so for a C, for a Wilson coefficient of order 1, the experimental constraints on this scale, given that we haven't seen proton decay, is also around 10 to the 15 GeV. Okay, so we see that things like neutrino masses and proton decay are sensitive to extremely high scales, okay? But they're completely blind to all kinds of other physics that don't violate these symmetries. Okay, the reason why we're sensitive to such high scales is because if something violated lepton or baryon number, then they'd show up in a very immediate and obvious way that we haven't seen. And indeed, yep.
Does that operator not violate the other symmetries, SU2L?
So I didn't put down the bars and the contractions on there, but you can form a singlet combination in color of the three quarks,
oh.
And they, yeah. Yeah, so exercise for the student, write down the, you know, the allowed terms. And actually, it was an exercise for the student that all the dimension six operators that one can write down. As I said, there's 2,499 of them, but really they're you know, copies of each generation. And there's three generations, so that creates a lot of multiplicities, and a lot of them are full Feynman operators. But there's really about, you know, 59 dimension six CP even operators. And these were first classified in the 80s, but they contained redundancies in the sense that, as you heard in the previous lecture, there are equations of motions that relate operators so that they're not all independent. And if you take into account all the redundancies and you reduce them to a non-redundant basis set, then you get about 59. And this was an exercise for the master student in 2010. Okay, and the first non-redundant basis of dimension six operators was done by a master student and now has thousands of citations. So, you know, there's always hope. You can still make big contributions with a master's thesis. What I was saying before that is baryon number violation, you know, would show up very obviously. This is why they're sensitive to very high scales. And indeed, one of the first constraints on baryon number violation before people went and looked for proton decay was the fact that we exist. In the sense that if protons decay too quickly, then we'd all die of cancer very quickly. Okay, so this placed already a lower bound on this scale lambda. I can't remember what it was, 10 to the 6 or 7 GeV or something like that. But you could say this is another type of anthropic principle that, you know, we exist, hence we can't have proton number below a certain scale. Now, the kind of effects that would show up at lower scales come from operators. Like, let me just give an example of how these different type of operators manifest themselves. But you can write down things like the H dagger d mu H combination with L bar gamma mu L, which when the Higgs gets a VeV and you take the Z boson from the covariant derivative, then this would modify the Z couplings to fermions in a way that is very well measured and constrained at LEP. So if there was some new physics modifying the Z couplings to leptons, and this new physics exists below a certain scale, then LEP says it can't be below about 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 5 GeV, depending on what the size of your coupling is to this new physics. Another type of operator, okay. And you would also get effects, for example, in Higgs physics, where you could have a modification of the Higgs coupling to these and the Z and so on. But since they're more constrained by the Z pole couplings, then you expect those effects in Higgs physics to be negligible. Okay. So this is another way in which EFT simplifies or correlates your phenomenology at low energies by correlating different measurements that measure different aspects of these operators. Another example is CG would modify, say, the Higgs couplings to gluons. You have the gluon field strength, g mu nu. And this, when the Higgs gets a VeV, modifies the vertex involving the Higgs coupling to gluons. And the fact that we've now observed the Higgs means the scale must be larger than about 100 GeV. Okay, if you have a loop factor in this CG. Okay, so we have an hour and a half, right? Not an hour.
Yes.
Okay, good. So you could have lied there and got out of it. So with the remaining half an hour, we're going to go through the rest of the 50 operators. No, story. That's actually what is a big area right now of particle physics is precisely to go through all the different ways in which we can constrain all of these operators not because we're stamp collectors and we want to just go through all the possibilities, but because each one of these operators is BSM. Okay? I once gave a talk at Slack where someone was saying, how can we get excited about measuring higher dimensional operators? And I was like, well, if you're not excited about BSM, then what can I say? I mean, trying to find signs of a non-zero Wilson coefficient is exactly what is one of the most exciting things about probing the effective field theory structure of the standard model. And in some sense, it's our job to figure out what are the constraints on these, given that we haven't seen anything so far, because that is sort of mapping out the negative space of the shape of UV physics. We haven't seen it in these different things, so we know that if UV physics exists, it can't be of the type that would give an effect already.
We have to match it to LEFT as well to understand that, you know, how this behaves at low energy.
Exactly. So this is what some people like me are working on, given that we don't do the experiments. We can either help reinterpret the experiments in terms of the effective field theory effects, or we can give some indication of what type of new physics would generate those effects. And then there's different ways of doing it, okay? And then you can do it at tree level, at one loop. You know, you could take into account the effects of running down. You could, you know, there's all kinds of things that that we do. Let me just give one last example involving a recent anomaly that has now gone away for the neutral current B anomalies. But they're a good example of, okay, again, this is schematic. There could be gamma matrices and so on in there. You have different types of operators. But if this is the B, involves the bottom quark, the strange quark, and the muons, then this would modify, say, a B meson going to a K meson plus a mu mu. Okay, and there was a lot of excitement about this because they'd been building up over a few years, consistent anomalies in different measurements. But it turns out that the cleanness of those measurements, the ratios to the electron process, turned out to be a mismeasurement because there's many things that are very difficult to control in these measurements. But the fact that they've gone away doesn't mean that these measurements are not interesting or motivated. They are some of the best constraints we have on the flavor structure of the high scales of new physics.
That is muon anti-muon or muon muon?
Yeah, mu anti-muon. And this would be the B quark inside the B going to an S quark, changing the B meson into a kaon. And you get all kinds of other, you get D mesons as well, you know, so those are the charge current neutral anomalies in the standard model, because this would be an operator generated in the standard model by the standard model itself with a Z boson and a loop factor. Okay, but in new physics, this could come from either a Z prime. Okay, you could have a heavy Z. So these are the kinds of physics that people were considering for tree level completions. Or you could have what's called a leptal quark, which is a scalar or a vector that has the right quantum numbers that it can couple to a quark and a lepton at a vertex. Okay. So it sounds kind of fancy, but there's no reason why you can't have a new particle that has the right quantum numbers under SU3, SU2, and U1, such that it can couple a quark and a lepton at a vertex. So you could also have loop-generated diagrams, but for new physics, the loop-generated diagrams were already excluded by other diagrams involving the mixing of BS. Well, that's a whole other thing I won't go into, but basically there's all kinds of interesting physics that goes on even just in, say, flavor physics. And this kind of scales that are constrained for these types of measurements are from the TeV to the hundreds of TeV scale. Okay. Okay, the effective field theory of the standard model, as I said, is not something new. We've been doing that with Fermi theory. And I want to give an argument for how, you know, we went beyond Fermi theory at the time. Okay, this is beyond Fermi theory. Just because that makes it clear how the low energy theory at the time mapped onto what we now know as the UV theory being the standard model. And the way it was arrived upon was a generalization of abelian to non-abelian in what was considered a nice mathematical generalization of the abelian structure to a non-abelian one, but was rejected by Pauli, who famously wouldn't let Yang continue his seminar in Zurich, because Pauli had already considered this generalization and realized that he couldn't give masses in a gauge invariant ways to these non-abelian gauge particles. And there, at the time, it was clear there was no other massless force particles in nature, so the theory was wrong from the outset. And when Yang couldn't explain how he gave a mass that he put in by hand, Pauli just kept pressing him and refused to let him continue the seminar. Okay. So this kind of nice mathematical generalization, which is immediately excluded by nature, is not always necessarily wrong. We now know the Higgs mechanism was a solution to that problem. But an independent argument for how we could have reached upon this is something a bit more in line with the amplitudes way of thinking, where if you just write down the amplitudes of Fermi theory, and those amplitudes grow with the energy squared. Okay, remember that there are higher dimensional operators that are suppressed by the 1 over lambda squared. But the amplitudes of 2 to 2 scattering must be massless. And so if the coupling is proportional to 1 over lambda squared, you dimensionally need something that goes like S, or the energy squared, since there's no other energy scale in your problem. So the amplitude has to grow like the energy squared and will violate unitarity at some scales. So you require something to come in to tame this energy growth. And this was known at the time as intermediate vector boson theory. You just add a vector boson in your theory in such a way, okay, that it could give you a finite amplitude. So great, your intermediate vector boson theory, where you added in this charged vector boson by hand, makes your theory finite. But then you can also write down another diagram where you have a neutrino and antineutrino going to the vector bosons that you introduced in your theory through an electron. And this diagram now grows with energy. Okay. So your theory can't be complete if it, the idea is that, you know, a truly fundamental theory will be finite. You can't have a fundamental theory that diverges, that breaks down, that gives you infinity. So you just try and do it by hand. You make it finite by adding couplings in a way that makes it finite. And so you add now a neutral vector boson. Okay, so you're trying to make this diagram finite of two neutrinos going to your charged vector bosons. And so you add a Ness channel diagram, and now it's finite. Okay. But again, you see where this is going. This is now finite, but you can do another diagram that this time grows linearly with energy, not quadratically. But even growing linearly with energy is still going to violate unitarity. So you can guess the next step in that process. What do we have to add to make this finite? Sorry, that is finite. The process that is now growing with energy is the diagram involving the neutral vector boson with the electron. And this now grows linearly with energy. Okay, when you add up all the diagrams. So. Okay. And so finally, you can add, and when I say finally, it's not so obvious, but it turns out that if you add a scalar particle, all the possible diagrams, and this could be a wavy line, are finite. Okay, now I'm skipping over lots of steps here. You know, when I say that you introduce these particles and then they give you something finite, when you introduce these particles, you have a free parameter, which is the couplings. You introduce, you know, these couplings. But it turns out that these parameters that you introduce to make the diagram finite have to reproduce exactly the values that they take in the standard model. Okay, so this is another way in which the non-abelian gauge structure of the standard model could have been derived in some sense just by requiring finiteness of your amplitudes.
Sorry, so but sort of conceptually, this is a different procedure than what we've been talking about for BSM, right? Because for BSM, we wrote down everything that's possible, sort of without arguing why it should be there apart from it can't be there. Whereas here, there was some contradiction in the low energy theory that required there to be a higher energy modification.
Yep.
So are these standard model operators, do some of them have the same sort of motivation, or are they just there?
So just to be clear, the motivation of writing down all possible operators, it's like saying now that we write down all the possible Fermi theory operators. Okay. Now, all of these possibilities are then constrained by data, and it turns out that they have this V minus A structure, where the gamma matrices involved in these operators are fixed by experiment to be a certain structure. And then this argument is just a theoretical argument for how one can start from these operators and then generate a UV theory that requires all of these different types of couplings and degrees of freedom in such a way as to make it finite. Okay. So this is, in a sense, independent of the previous effective field theory picture where all the operators have to be there. Okay. Now, where this is different in the standard model is that the standard model, unlike the low energy Fermi theory had before, we have no signs of a non-zero Wilson coefficient, apart from these anomalies that now went away. And in a sense, we know now, non-abelian structure, Higgs mechanisms, and all that. Okay, so we don't really have to play these games anymore. This was done in the 80s by people like Chris Quigg and Benjamin Lee and Llewellyn Smith and others. Okay, but it's sort of a different type of argument of, let's say, writing down a Lagrangian. Okay, writing down your symmetries and then trying to find the generalization of your symmetries. And the reason why I mentioned this is because we'll come back to later when we discuss supersymmetry. All the analogies of supersymmetry, I think, is in parallel with the development of the standard model. Okay, the type of aesthetic arguments that we did in generalizing the structures that led to general relativity through the geometric arguments of Einstein, to the mathematical generalizations of Lie algebras that, you know, took us from abelian to non-abelian, to the different amplitude-like arguments that also lead you to the same structure, okay, is in some ways the many different arguments that one can make for supersymmetry. Okay, so I'll come back to this in detail later. Okay, so let me just emphasize the picture here is the energy scale, okay, at which we're hoping to discover new physics, lambda, let's say, is above about a TeV. Okay. I mean, there's still possibilities for new physics to be below that, but they'd have to be weakly coupled. They'd have to have some structure that might make them harder to find and so on. But let's just say that on the face of it, new physics wants to be heavier than a TeV. And then we have the electroheat scale. And this unknown UV theory at low energies generates not just the standard model Lagrangian, but the dimension 5 and dimension 6 and so on. Okay. We know that this effective field theory structure describes nature in the sense that already around the GeV scale below the W mass, we have the Fermi theory and the Euler-Heisenberg theory. Okay. Which the standard model generates. And there's another type of effective field theory, which are known as nonlinear Carrot-Lagrangians, which describe the types of low energy theories that come from symmetry breaking of global symmetries. Like, for example, when QCD confines the theory of pions and kaons below the scale of QCD confinement at the MeV scale is described by the pion, the Carrot-Lagrangian of the pion and kaons and so on. So when we talk about composite Higgs, we'll discuss a bit this type of low energy effective field theory. Now, we've talked about how, again, the types of new physics like leptoquarks that would generate an interaction between quarks and leptons at low energies feeds into this type of full Feynman operator that is constrained here. There's also some interesting different ways in which we can be sensitive to the UV theory by measuring precisely the coefficients at dimension 8. And this was something that you heard about at the end of your lecture in terms of very generic arguments for the unitarity, causality, and locality of your UV theory. Giving what are called positivity bounds on your Wilson coefficient of dimension 8 operators. So this is a nice argument because it says no matter what your UV theory, maybe it doesn't even have a Lagrangian description. Maybe it's some crazy theory that is not even a quantum field theory. But whatever that theory is, just by virtue of assuming it obeys unitarity, causality, and locality, it can tell you something about the sign of the Wilson coefficient of your low energy theory, which sounds kind of surprising at face value in the sense that the whole picture of effective field theory is that these things decouple. The UV theory effects decouple, and then the low energy theory captures these things inside the Wilson coefficients. But in principle, you can write down any Wilson coefficient and you can constrain those parameters. But the fact that they tell you something about the UV in a very generic sense just by these assumptions without having to do an explicit matching calculation to some specific UV theory is based on, again, this kind of amplitude argument where a 2-2-2 scattering amplitude will only depend on S and T. And in the forward limit, you take T equals 0. And so it's just a function of S. And this amplitude at low energies is going to be some polynomial in S. It's going to depend on S through some coefficients. And as I mentioned before, your higher dimensional operator will go like 1 over lambda squared, 1 over lambda to the fourth for a dimension 8 operator. But because the amplitude has to be massless, this means it has to grow like S squared. Okay. Now, what you heard about in the last lecture was the fact that in the complex plane, this amplitude has a known structure with the branch cuts and the poles. And you can pick out the coefficients using the residue theorem by writing this amplitude. If you want to pick out the S squared coefficient, then 1 over S cubed, when you do a contour integral around the pole, picks out the residue, which is the coefficient of your dimension 8 contribution to this amplitude. Now, the reason why this is useful is that using the residue theorem, you can deform this. This is the same result. Okay, your dimension 8 Wilson coefficient is going to be proportional to this contour integral. And now this contour integral can be deformed to a new contour C prime, which is the same. And assuming the Froissart bound, which was already explained to you, that the fact that the amplitude is limited in how in its high energy growth behavior means that this must die off. And so this integral over over the UV and then the integral over the branch cuts means that this dies off. We're left with the integrals over the branch cuts, which is the amplitude at plus I epsilon, minus I epsilon. And then this is related to the complex conjugate of S plus I epsilon by the Cauchy-Schwarz something something. And then this is basically the imaginary part of the amplitude, which by the optical theorem is the cross section, which is positive. OK, so that's a very, I mean, it's almost magical in some ways that you can, through purely theoretical arguments of complex analysis and the residue theorem and things which are just some nice calculational tools, you can know something about UV physics. And these types of very generic arguments then tell you that the coefficients of some dimension 8 operators, even if you don't know anything about the UV physics that generates them, some combination of dimension 8 coefficients have to be positive. So now imagine that an experimentalist goes and measures these things at some future collider that allows you enough precision to access these operators and measures the combination that you say should be positive. Then you'd expect whatever they measure, if they find signs of a non-zero value, it has to be in this quadrant. Okay. And this is a very cool way of connecting, you know, UV physics with phenomenology and experiment, in the sense that imagine someday they measure something very precisely and it lies down here. Okay. The implications of measuring something here through these type of theoretical arguments that are very general would then tell you experimentally that your UV theory has to violate one of these fundamental assumptions. Okay. This is a bit like when you do a precision measurement of the orbits of planets, which was very well understood through Newtonian gravity, and you find a small deviation. This is what happened for Uranus, and the small deviation was accounted for by adding a new planet that was Neptune. And indeed, the theoretical prediction of where this planet should be led to Le Verrier to point his telescope there and discover Neptune. So Neptune was the first theoretically discovered planet. And it's a bit like dark matter. We have an anomaly, you know, we predict a new particle, and we're still looking for that particle. But the precession of Mercury was also a small deviation, also led to the prediction of a new planet Vulcan, but this time we didn't find any planet Vulcan. And it turns out that that precision measurement really led to an overhaul of the framework of the time, that gravity was not Newtonian gravity, but required a whole different framework for understanding gravity that in general relativity is understood. So while this isn't especially, you know, compelling in any way, it's just an existence proof of something that could happen, where we could go to higher energies or higher precision at a future collider, make a very precise measurement of something that slack people find boring, apparently, and then find that it lies in a quadrant and when we go to even higher energies at 100 TeV collider, find that this theory is not even describable by unitary, local, and causal quantum field theory, okay? We just don't know, and we're a bit too complacent about the fact that we think we know everything that happens at the TeV scale, when unless we look, we just won't know whether or not it still agrees with our current framework. Yes.
What justifies using the Froissart bound when it comes to doing
the UV input? Oh, the Froissart bound is something which has some very nice arguments from a kind of physical picture where I'll try and remember what it is and come back to you on that. It's involving the scattering of particles, and then the consistency of the scattering of these particles leads to a limit on how fast they can grow with energy. But there's many more formal proofs of why the Froissart bound has to hold at high energies. Okay. These are all things that were proven in the 60s, actually. So, you know, these are all sort of going back to a type of physics that was done back in the time when, again, QFT was becoming unfashionable. This is precisely why all of these methods of looking at amplitudes and trying to find out as much as possible about physics without Lagrangians was because people considered QFT to be a dead end at the time. Okay, and we're sort of going in circles in that now we again feel like we're missing something in terms of, you know, we don't understand naturalness, we don't understand the cosmological constant, and it seems like the usual symmetry-based approaches that we've been trying to solve these problems aren't what nature has chosen. So given the fact that, and then there's, well, gravity, quantum gravity as well is telling us that, you know, we don't have a complete framework theoretically yet, okay? So there's a sense that maybe we need to go beyond our usual quantum field theory structure, and this is pushing a lot of developments in formal theory, and it's pushing a lot of developments in BSM in terms of considering crazier models than before. So in some ways, we're in more exciting times now than back when we expected everything to just be supersymmetry or the composite models that we expected to find at the LHC. So while some people may think it's disappointing, I think this is actually even more exciting than the kind of theories that we've been considering until now. So tomorrow, I'll try and go through some of these problems and the motivations for these old types of theories and why they seemed especially compelling at the time. And if you have any questions about what I just talked about or what you'd like to see in the next few lectures, they're not set in stone yet, so feel free to email me to suggest some things you'd like to hear about, and I'll try and mention them. Hey, thank you.